It's 9:30 on Monday, November 10th, here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is a reading of the Green Valley News. Mark DeGroft with you this morning. Pima County Sheriff's Department crime statistics show the Green Valley continues to be a safe place, with the area accounting for just 2.5% of all crimes that are reported within unincorporated Pima County. According to the statistics, 145 serious crimes were reported in the first 10 months of 2025, compared to 256 reported calls during all of 2023 and 200 in all of 2024. Called Part 1 crimes by the FBI, they include homicides, sexual assaults, robberies, aggravated assaults, burglaries, larcenies, auto thefts, and arson fires. Similar to statistics from the past years, 60% or 87 of the crimes reported so far this year were larcenies, which include shoplifting statistics show. The next highest crime category was burglaries, which accounted for 23 of the crimes, or 16%. What's hurting Green Valley the most when it comes to crimes is fraud, said Lieutenant Brett Bernstein, the Green Valley District Commander. In Green Valley, our deputies are responding mostly to non-criminal things, like check welfares and making sure this house is safe before we get to Santa River Fire over there, things like that. But when it comes to crimes, it's fraud. Green Valley accounts for 3% of the county's population, but nearly 12% of the fraud calls, Bernstein said. Through November 1st, deputies have taken 91 fraud calls. While that's down compared to a high of 157 in 2022 and 116 in 2024, it's too many, Bernstein said. He said that attributes the high numbers to the demographics in Green Valley. While the average age of crime victims over the last 2 years in all of the Sheriff's Department districts was age 58, it was 69 in the Green Valley district, he said. Judging from the reports that he sees, those being victimized tend to be people who don't watch or read the news or the scam notifications that are sent out by their banking institutions. He was asked at a Green Valley Council Board of Representatives meeting last month what the Sheriff's Department is doing to educate people. My response was, I can think of anything else that we can do. We're on the news. We're in the news. We're sending out flyers. We offer classes. We're on the web. Short of knocking on everybody's door, I'm not really sure what else there is that we can do to help these people understand the risks of getting involved in these type of things, he said. The Green Valley's District Scam Squad offers presentations by request to any size groups. They can also be contacted on the phone and by email. If someone's at home and they get a text message and they're just not sure if this is real, they can call the Scam Squad, Bernstein said. Our fraud unit is one of the best in the nation. They're an incredible group of guys who go far and beyond the requirements of an investigator. They have all these incredible videos that they made of the six main types of scams that come through, and I find them extremely easy to understand. They're really made for the layman to understand what they may come up against with these scams, and then you can see it. Green Valley residents are fortunate to live in a community filled with good neighbors who watch out for each other and an active Sheriff's Auxiliary Volunteers Program, he said. SAV operates the scam squad. What I would say is that people come together better in Green Valley than anywhere else in the Tucson Valley, he said. It has nothing to do with the demographics, you know, the generation to which they belong. I meet a lot of people who have been involved in the military or have had these 40 to 50 year long nursing careers and science careers, and now they're here to give back, and it works great. Green Valley District has the most seniority out of any of the districts within Pima County. What I mean by that is that there's a lot more compiled years of experience in Green Valley with our deputies than anywhere else, he said. And once they're assigned down here, they love it, he added. I think one of the reasons is because they really fall in love with the people that they're helping here, Bernstein said. They get a lot of support, and it makes them want to stay, and it makes them want to keep giving. The Arizona Department of Transportation wrapped up sensor upgrades at the Canoa Ranch Rest Area on I-19 in late October. ADOT's Canoa Ranch Rest Area project began on September 3rd and replaced the Weigh-In Motion system with an automated tire pressure screening. ADOT also upgraded existing system controllers, installed new loop sensors, and installed a sensor plate next to the existing loops. Well, number 13 Walden Grove suffered a season-ending defeat at home on Friday night, falling 52-46 to number 20 Phoenix Northwest Christian in the first round of the 4A state playoffs after giving up a 22-point lead in the fourth quarter. The Crusaders scored 28 unanswered points to close the game, recovering two late outside kicks in the comeback. Walden Grove had a shot to win in the waning seconds but couldn't score on a fourth and goal from the 9-yard line. "They just executed and we didn't," Walden Grove head coach Corey Noble said. "We made way too many mistakes at the end there. They did a great job coaching and I did a bad job coaching. So it's the situational stuff. We obviously weren't ready for it, so I need to have us ready for those things." Walden Grove and Northwest Christian have faced each other five times in the regular season and postseason play in the recent years, and while the Red Wolves have lost four of the five meetings, Walden Grove earned its first playoff win in program history last season with the victory at the Northwest Christian in the first round of the 4A state playoffs before falling to Yuma Catholic in the quarterfinals. "They're a good team. They're an experienced team," Noble said of Northwest Christian. "A lot of playoff experience, a lot of guys played a lot of football, and they came out on top tonight." Though the season for the Red Wolves concluded in heartbreaking fashion, Noble noted that the team had a lot to celebrate at the upcoming team banquet. "We had big goals and big aspirations for this year, and I just wish I would have had them ready to do it because I think we could have accomplished a few more of them," Noble said. "But we accomplished a lot of things, had a lot of really good stuff going on this year, and this senior class is a great group, a special group." And Noble has led the Red Wolves to five playoff appearances in his nine seasons leading the program. This next story is part of an ongoing series that celebrates the upcoming American birthday by honoring significant individual contributions. And Walt Disney had this talent. He could draw. He would abound in his formal education to pursue his dream. Born in Chicago suburbs in 1901, his childhood environs growing up in the Missouri were anything but pleasant. After several jobs honing his abilities, he and his older brother Roy headed to California with plans for developing Walt's skills. His breakthrough effort was a short animated film in 1928 called Steamboat Willie. This classic introduced the character Mickey Mouse to the viewing public. The big screen's cartoon mania resulted. Disney supplied his own voice for the early Mickey adventures. Other notables sprung from the Disney drawing board: Goofy, the long-limbed dog creature, debuted in 1932. The adversarial Donald Duck appeared in 1934, mainly as a foil to Mickey. The popularity of the Disney animation craze led to full-length feature films as well. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs hit the screen in 1937, Pinocchio in 1940, Dumbo in 1941, and Bambi in 1942. "When, as a small child, I saw Bambi a few years later, we were in the sticks, so films were late arriving. I must confess to tearing up when Bambi's mother died." The niche Disney created continued. Cinderella was a hit in 1950. Sleeping Beauty drew raves in 1959, and Mary Poppins blew off the roof of Hollywood in 1964, garnering five Oscars. In all, Walt Disney was nominated 59 times by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and then took home 22 Oscars, which is an unreachable record. But Walt wasn't done. He easily segued to the small screen. The Mickey Mouse Club became a staple for youngsters of the 1950s, an offshoot of a variety of fan clubs attached to the Entertaining Mouse since 1929. It featured Teen Mouseketeers as a backdrop. From a male point of view, Annette Funicello was the favorite. We delighted in her obvious physical progression from 1959-55 through 59. For the girls, there was Johnny Crawford, who would later star with Chuck Connors in the popular The Rifleman series. For most entrepreneurs, this would be the pinnacle, but for Disney, this was just the beginning of a global empire. The Disneyland theme park opened in 1955. It was by far his greatest innovation. His Magic Kingdom was next on the drawing boards. Unfortunately, Walt didn't see its fruition. He died in 1966. Brother Roy, the financial linchpin, carried it to the finish line in 1971, and then Epcot followed in 1982. Disney was a very private man, despite the hoopla that surrounded his success. He was attacked for being an anti-Semite as the result of an adversarial relationship with Herb Sorrell, a former Disney animator and distinctive labor organizer. Sorrell led a strike against the Disney film studio in 1941. Adding to the angst between the two men, Walt testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee and proclaimed Sorrell was a communist, never proven. Sorrell, a Jewish man, started a whisper campaign that Walt was anti-Semitic, and that, too, was never verified. Walt Disney's genius and his vision produced an incredibly profound and lasting checkmark on the American culture. His branding serves as a permanent reminder of his galactic-sized contribution to the American dream. The median age of a first-time homebuyer in the United States has climbed a record of 40, as soaring prices and mortgage rates over the last few years have delayed home ownership for millions of Americans. The age at which people purchase their first home has climbed rapidly since 2021, when the median was 33. This according to a National Association of Realtors survey of transactions from 2024 of July through June. In 1981, when the survey was first conducted, the median age was 29 years old. NAR's annual profile of buyers and sellers that was released on Tuesday portrays a housing market in which younger, cash-strapped Americans are struggling to become homeowners, while a wealthier, often older cohort is able to make bigger down payments and pay cash for houses. The NAR warned that the loss of a decade of home ownership could cost Americans roughly $150,000 in equity on a typical starter home. The median price of an existing home currently stands at $415,200, and that's up more than 50% since 2019. At the same time, mortgage rates are roughly twice as high as they were in late 2021. The implications for the housing market are staggering, Jessica Lotz, NAR's chief deputy economist, said in a statement. Today's first-time buyers are building less housing wealth and will likely have fewer moves over their lifetime as a result. And over the past year, first-time buyers accounted for 21% of the market, the lowest since the NAR program began collecting such data back in 1981, and about half of the pre-2008 norm. As with first-timers, the typical repeat buyer is also older, rising to 62 this year from 61 a year earlier. They typically also have much more money to spend, with repeat buyers making medium down payments of 23%, which is the highest level since 2003. The share of all cash buyers matched a record 26%, dominated by baby boomers paying cash for their next homes in retirement, Lotz said in an email. NAR mailed the surveys in July, collecting 6,103 survey responses, mostly from buyers who purchased a home between July of 2024 and June for their primary residence. New forensic information has led to an arrest in a 1984 killing in Sierra Vista, the Cochise County Sheriff's Department says. Gregory Hammon, 60 years old, was arrested on suspicion of killing Joseph Montgomery, the department said on Friday in a news release. Montgomery lived above a beauty salon called Hairport when he was killed in his apartment. Additional scientific testing and forensic analysis offered new evidence that led investigators to identify Hammon as a suspect in the case, the release said. Hammon was arrested on one count of first-degree murder and held on an $800,000 bond. Our investigators have remained steadfast in their pursuit of justice for the victim and their family, Sheriff Mark Daniels said in the release. The advancements in forensic science have provided us the tools to bring resolution to cases once thought to be unsolvable. And the investigation continues. About 24 people were arrested for warrants, and 5 tons of debris was removed from four homeless encampments in Tucson during a recent sweep by police and its city agencies. A dozen people accepted services during the October 30th Safe City operation, according to officials. Law enforcement is working in tandem with drug treatment and housing assistance. The Arizona food stamp recipients apparently won't get benefits as soon as this weekend. Late on Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court temporarily blocked a federal judge's order directing the U.S. Department of Agriculture to immediately fund the November monthly payments for all 42 million Americans, including about 900,000 here in Arizona, who qualify for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. In a brief, unsigned order, the justices said they want time for an appellate court to consider a claim by the Trump administration that U.S. District Court Judge John McConnell acted illegally. McConnell said that the USDA must not use just the approximately $5.3 billion it has in contingency funds for SNAP, but that take the balance needed from other programs, including one that funds school meals. The total cost of full benefits is between $8.5 and $9 million. All this comes just hours after Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, in a social media post, said that benefits were on the way. Arizonans have started receiving their SNAP benefits in full, she wrote late on Friday afternoon, before the Supreme Court order. Over the coming days, SNAP recipients should see their November benefits loaded onto their card. Christian Slater, the governor's press aide, said Friday that evening that he has no details of how many Arizonans have bad money for November loaded onto their electronic benefit transfer cards, or how many got full payments. The average monthly payment to Arizona households is $358. That means another delay, and how long is unclear for Arizonans who've been waiting for their benefits for a week. In the court order on Friday night, the justices first said that the First Circuit Court of Appeals said that it intends to issue its own order on whether to stay full benefits as quickly as possible. They gave themselves another 48 hours to consider whatever the appellate court rules. The latest developments could leave Arizona recipients scrambling to find out whether they have money to spend this month on groceries and, if so, just how much. Arizona's Department of Economic Security maintains a cardholder portal that has current balances as well as a record of transactions. DES says that recipients can also check their balances by using the EBT card at an ATM or point-of-sale terminal that accepts EBT, but the agency warns that a fee may apply. All this comes amid a flurry of activity, including court rulings and often conflicting statements from the federal government, in the wake of the U.S. government shutdown and failure of Congress to approve funding for SNAP benefits program beyond October 31st. But that didn't stop Trump from appealing the order, and when he couldn't get an immediate delay from the Court of Appeals, he went to the Supreme Court. In filings with the High Court, U.S. Solicitor General D. John Sauer told the justices the government has already exhausted its contingency funds. Some signs of progress and optimism are emerging that the Colorado River Basin's seven states could reach a short-term agreement on water use curbs by Tuesday, although not the 20-year deal that many outside experts say is essential to protect the river from continued depletion. Two persons, one from each of the river's upper and lower basins, expressed some degree of hope on Friday that such a deal is possible. However, a third source familiar with the talks downplayed that possibility, saying the two basins remain really far apart on some key issues. Negotiators for the seven states have been discussing various versions of a short-term plan in which Arizona and the other two lower Colorado basin states, California and Nevada, would agree to start in 2027 to carry out a cut of about 1.25 million acre-feet a year in water use for 5 years. Mexico, the lower basin officials hope, would agree to cut an additional 250,000 acre-feet to bring the total annual savings to 1.5 million acre-feet per year. Arizona, California, and Nevada have already pledged to make such cuts during ongoing negotiations over the river, but have not until now agreed to do that on a specific date, several sources have told the paper. In return, the deal being discussed would have the upper basin states, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, agree to set aside 100,000 pure acre feet a year for 5 years in Lake Powell for conservation purposes, to be released when necessary during bad years on the river. Pima County supervisors have approved freeing up some funds to make sure that the country's Women, Infant, and Children, the WIC program, remains operational through this month amid the federal government shutdown. Supervisors late last week approved providing $399,440 in interim funding to ensure instant food and formula benefits go uninterrupted through the end of November. WIC benefits are currently available only until mid-November through the Arizona Health Department of Health Services, the county said. The country's funds will allow benefits to continue through the end of the month for more than 4,400 infants, the county said. Pima County Administrator Jan Lesher said it's her hope that this is simply interim funding. The county's program receives funding through the state and federal governments, Lesher said, and it is our hope, our belief, that those funds will be reimbursed, but there is no 100% guarantee of that. And early last week, $450 million in additional federal funding had been allocated to the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women and Children, according to the National WIC Association, which is a nonprofit organization that works with public health nutrition service provider agencies across the country. But that's only a temporary fix, the NWICA said. From West Palm Beach, Florida, the White House said yesterday it would be beautiful to name the new stadium for Washington's NFL team after President Donald Trump, following an ESPN report that an intermediary has told the Commanders ownership group that he wants it to bear his name. Trump could deliver the message in person today when he's expected to watch the Commanders play the Lions at Northwest Stadium in Landover, Maryland. American veterans are scheduled to be honored at halftime. That would surely be a beautiful name, as it was President Trump who made the rebuilding of the new stadium possible, said Caroline Leavitt, press secretary for the Republican president. A spokesperson for the Washington Commanders told the Associated Press in a text message that the team had no comment on the report. The office of the city's mayor, Democrat Muriel Bowser, declined comment. Under a deal announced in April between the team and the District of Columbia, the team will return to the nation's capital in a new stadium expected to cost nearly $4 billion. It will be built on the site of the old RFK Stadium, where the team played for more than three decades when it won three Super Bowls in the 1980s and 90s. Democratic President Joe Biden signed a bill late last year to transfer land, which included that old stadium, from the federal government to the city. The deal, with the team contributing $2.7 billion and the city investing roughly $1.1 billion for the stadium, housing, green space, and a sports complex on land bordering the Anacostia River, was approved by the D.C. City Council in September, and demolition has begun. In July, Trump threatened to hold up the deal by insisting that the team change its name from the Commanders back to the Redskins, a name that was considered offensive to our Native Americans. Trump has long enjoyed having his name appear on things, from his career as real estate developer, from high-rise buildings, hotels, golf courses, to his branding deals that have seen Trump emblazon Bibles, watches, and cologne. Today in history, in 1906, Theodore Roosevelt made the first trip abroad of any sitting president in order to observe construction of the Panama Canal. In 1935, United Mine Workers President John L. Lewis and other labor leaders formed the Committee for Industrial Organization, or the CIO. In 1938, Nazis looted and burned synagogues as well as thousands of Jewish-owned stores and houses in Germany and Austria in what became known as Kristallnacht. In 1965, The Great Northeast Blackout began with a series of power failures that lasted up to 13 and a half hours, leaving 30 million people in seven states and part of Canada without electricity. In 1976, the UN General Assembly approved resolutions condemning apartheid in South Africa, including one characterizing the white rule government as illegitimate. In 1989, Communist East Germany threw open its borders, allowing citizens to travel freely for the first time in decades, a landmark event often referred to as the fall of the Berlin Wall. And in 2007, President General Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan placed opposition leader Benazir Bhutto under house arrest for a day and rounded up thousands of her supporters to block a mass rally against his emergency rule. Bhutto would be assassinated weeks later on December 27th. For a day at least, beleaguered Democrats were hopeful again, but just beneath the party's relief at securing its first big electoral wins since November's drubbing lay unresolved questions about its direction heading into next year's midterm elections. The election day romp of Republicans stretched from deep blue New York and California to swing states Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. There were signs that key voting groups, including young people, blacks, and Hispanics who shifted toward President Trump, Republican Party just a year ago, may be shifting back. And Democratic leaders across the political spectrum coalesced behind a simple message focused on Trump's failures to address rising costs and everyday kitchen table issues. The dominant performance sparked a new round of debate among the party's establishment-minded pragmatists and fiery progressives over which approach led to Tuesday's victories and which path to take into the high-stakes 2026 midterm elections and beyond. The lessons Democrats learn from the victories will help determine the party's leading message and messengers next year, when elections will decide the balance of power in Congress for the second half of Trump's term, and potentially in the 2028 presidential race, which has already entered its earliest stages. And that takes care of the Green Valley News for this Monday. Thank you so much for listening and joining me. Stay tuned to more Sun Sounds programming. I'll be back on Wednesday. Till then, take care.